Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
ODC to appoint four new members to Compliance Committee Thursday by OA News. The Odessa Development Corporation is expected to appoint and reappoint members to its Compliance Committee during its regular monthly meeting Thursday. A few months ago, the ODC board agreed it wanted to expand the Compliance Committee up to a maximum of 12 members, up from 10, said board member David Bowden. With one member resigning and one terming out, the board will be appointing four new members Thursday. In addition, the board will be reappointing three current members whose terms are up and appointing a president, vice president, and assistant secretary. There will also be a discussion about appointing ODC board members to committee. Also on Thursday's agenda is a discussion about possibly revising the Standard Economic Development Performance Agreement and a presentation to outgoing ODC board member Jeff Russell, who was removed from the ODC by a 4-3 council vote January 11th. Council members Steve Thompson and Mary Willis called for Russell to be removed after he participated in discussions about a Roads USA proposal at a December ODC meeting, despite telling Chairman Tim Eggman he had a business relationship with Roads USA. They also said he didn't file conflict of interest paperwork in a timely manner. Russell told council members he was mistaken and he actually doesn't have a business relationship with the company. As the paperwork, Russell said Eggman didn't tell him he needed to file such paperwork. Those who voted to oust Russell said his behavior caused the appearance of impropriety. Councilmember Denise Swainer, who appointed Russell to the ODC, strenuously objected to his removal, alleging Thompson himself has had conflict of interest and failed to remove himself from discussions. Thompson has denied the allegations. Harmony Science Academy to host STEM Expo by OA News. Students from Harmony Science Academy will be displaying and demonstrating the latest science, technology, energy, and math STEM project at the Harmony Science Academy Saturday at Music City Mall, 4101 East 42nd Street in front of the movie theater. Hours are noon to 3 p.m. The Harmony Science Academy STEM Expo will feature approximately 30 projects submitted by students. Project categories include elementary, physics, chemistry, biology, and tech, engineering, and robotics. Students will present their projects to the public and a panel of judges where they will be competing to win first through third place. Harmony Public Schools are 58 high-performing pre-K-12 college preparatory charter schools throughout Texas. Harmony blends the highest standards and expectations with a rigorous math and science-centered curriculum, and dedicated and engaged teachers and families to cultivate excellence and prepare students to succeed in college, careers, and life. At Harmony public schools, we believe every child can succeed, and we are committed to helping them realize their full potential. Obituaries. Robert Lynn Grimes. Granberry. Robert Lynn Grimes of Granberry, Texas, passed away at the age of 67. The family will receive friends on Thursday, February 10th, 2022, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Naley Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home in Midland. Memorial service will be held on Friday, February 11th at 2 p.m. at First Baptist Church Chapel in Midland. He passed away Sunday, February 6, 2022. Robert Lynn Grimes was born on August 6, 1954, to the late Ora Bell and Robert Leland Grimes in Comanche, Texas. He met his wife, Laura, soon after. They married not long after meeting and were nearing their 48th wedding anniversary. He is survived by his wife, Laura, his daughter, Jennifer James, and husband, Sam, his son, Robert Grimes, and wife, Bobby. He is survived by two granddaughters. He also leaves behind his sister, Jeannie Miller, and husband, Tom, and sister-in-law, Leora Grimes. He is survived by many family members and dear friends. Robert cherished ministering to the homeless of the Midland area. In lieu of flowers, please consider donation to the Field's Edge at Post Office Box 50068, Midland, Texas 79710. Arrangements are under the direction of Natalie Pickle Welsh and Funeral Home. Anita Childress Elms, Odessa. Anita Childress Elms passed from this world on February 4th. Anita met Bill Elms while in high school. They were married for almost 60 years. Anita was preceded in death by her son, Stephen Elms, in 1988, her sister, Doris Smith, in 2008, and her husband, Bill Elms, in 2012. Celebrating her life are her children, Tracy, Terry, and Clark, and their families, as well as sisters, Jackie Bell and Janie Widener. A family burial will take place on Friday, February 11th at 2 p.m. and a memorial service at 3 at Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home, followed by a reception at the Odessa Country Club. In lieu of flowers, memorial glyphs may be made to the Permian Basin Rehabilitation Center. Non-profit providing speech, physical, occupational therapy, and hearing services, or to the Texas Exis Steve Wade Elms Memorial Scholarship. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens. Cinderella Carrasco, Odessa. Belma Cinderella Cindy Dutchover Carrasco was born in Pecos, Texas on August 16, 1932, to Ben and Lucille Dutchover of Balmoray, Texas. Cindy married Robert Martinez Carrasco on August 26, 1951. Cindy is preceded in death by her father, mother, daughter Dolores, and son Benjamin. Those left to remember her are her husband, Robert of Odessa, daughter Doris Biddy of Midland, three granddaughters, sister Faye Alexander of Mansfield, and eight great-grandchildren. Visitation for Cindy Carrasco will be at Odessa Funeral Home Tuesday, February 8th from 4 to 8 p.m. Rosary will be at 7 p.m. Cindy's celebration of life will be at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church on Wednesday, February 9th at 10 a.m., followed by her burial at Ector County Cemetery. The family respectfully requests donations be made to Home Hospice of Odessa in lieu of flowers. Linda Easley, Sunnyvale. Linda Sue Easley, age 75 of Odessa and Sunnyvale, Texas, passed from this life into eternity on Friday, February 4th at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center, Sunnyvale. Linda and the love of her life, Jimmy Easley, eloped on December 31st, 1964. Linda is preceded in death by her son, Lance Easley, mother, Ava Lou Smith, father and mother-in-law, Arliss and Moline Easley, and sister, Betty Smith Southern. To those left to cherish her memory are her loving husband, Jim Easley, son, Shane Easley of Brownwood, and daughter, Shanae Holditch, and husband, Brian of Sunnyvale. Four grandchildren, one great-granddaughter, brothers Wayne Smith and wife Jan of McCamey, and Ronnie Smith and wife Diane of Odessa, brothers-in-law Ed Easley and wife Elaine of Odessa, and Les Sutherland of Houston, numerous cousins, nieces, nephews, and other friends and family members. James Berry Sykes. James Berry Sykes of Odessa passed away Friday, January 28th at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, Texas. Berry was born in Big Spring, Texas to Abbott B. and Melba Preston Sykes on July 14, 1954. Berry is predeceased by his father and mother, his brother Stephen Sykes, his maternal and paternal grandparents, and many extended family members. He is survived by his older sister, Judy Dalton, and John of Cloudcroft, New Mexico, his youngest brother, Nathan Sykes of Providence, Rhode Island, nieces, nephews, his aunt, Kay Preston of Abilene, Texas, and Margie Weller of Denver, Colorado, and several cousins and their families. The memorial service for Berry Sykes will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday, February 9th at Grace Christian Fellowship in Odessa. Sunset Funeral Home is managing arrangements. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made in Berry's memory to these scholarship programs. Berry Sykes Memorial Scholarship Award by Permian Football Booster Club, and Berry Sykes Memorial Endowed Scholarship by the University of Texas Permian Basin. Death Notices. Glenn Alexander Boyd, Odessa. Glenn Alexander Boyd, 54, died Wednesday, February 2nd in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home. Ada Brihalba, Odessa. Ada Brihalba, 94 of Odessa, died Monday, January 31st in Odessa. Mass is scheduled to be celebrated at 10 a.m. February 11th at Holy Redeemer. Visitation will be located at Odessa Funeral Home, Thursday, February 10th, from 4 to 8 p.m. Burial will follow at Saragossa Cemetery. Arrangements are by Odessa Funeral Home. Robert Jr. Brown, Odessa. Robert Jr. Brown, 91 of Odessa, died Saturday, February 5th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Tuesday, February 15th at Northside Baptist Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. The family will receive friends for visitation Monday, February 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. Brian Henry Fisher, Odessa. Brian Henry Fisher, 64 of Odessa, died Tuesday, February 1st in Odessa. Visitation is scheduled from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. February 10th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Ricardo Isaac Lizalde, Odessa. Ricardo Isaac Lizalde, 25, died Tuesday, August 31st in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home. Francisco Galvin Moreno, Odessa. Francisco Galvin Moreno, 88, of Odessa, died Sunday, February 6th in Odessa. Chapel service will be held for Rosary at 7 p.m. Wednesday, February 9th at Martinez Funeral Home. Burial will be a later date in Chihuahua, Mexico. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home. June Ragsdale, Odessa. June Ragsdale, 83, of Odessa, died Sunday, January 30th in Odessa. Graveside service is scheduled for 2 p.m. on Friday, February 11th at the Rose Hill section of Victor County Cemetery. The family will receive friends for visitation at the funeral home on Thursday, February 10th from 4 to 6 p.m. Arrangements are by Frank W. Wilson, Funeral Directors of Odessa. Wanda L. Sides, Midland. Wanda L. Sides, 89, of Midland, died Saturday, January 29th in Midland. Graveside service is scheduled for 11 a.m. on Saturday, February 12th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Frank W. Wilson, Funeral Directors. Dorothy Mae McAllister Skidmore, Odessa. Dorothy Mae McAllister Skidmore, 95, of Odessa, died Monday, January 31st in Odessa. Graveside service is scheduled for 1 p.m. Thursday, February 10th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Home. Maria Magdalena Tenorio, Odessa. Maria Magdalena Tenorio, 80, died Monday, February 7th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home of Odessa.
This is Jane reading for the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, February 9th from the Health and Wellness section. Properly dispose of medications and sharps. Place them in disposal drop box with no questions asked anytime, any day. Midland Health now offers a convenient, safe, and secure way for our community to dispose of unwanted over-the-counter and prescription medications. Did you know storing unwanted and expired medications increases the risk of misuse and potentially places children, seniors, and pets at risk for accidental poisoning? Each year, more than $1 billion worth of leftover drugs are thrown in the trash, flushed, or relegated to the back of the medicine cabinets. When drugs are disposed of in the garage, poured down the drain, or flushed, they end up in the environment. Medications poured down the drain, or the flushing of medication, results in these medications being sent to wastewater treatment plants that are not designed to remove them. Unused medications in the home are a potential source of drug abuse in millions of homes, with the opioid crisis in the United States fueled in part by that availability. More than 70% of young people abusing prescription pain relievers get them through friends or family, most often from the family medicine cabinet. Unfortunately, more than 22,000 people die each year from misuse of prescription drugs. Our drug disposal drop box is conveniently located just inside the main emergency department entrance at Midland Memorial Hospital. This drop box is a great answer to the problems associated with proper drug disposal, and it's simple to do. The drug disposal drop box is a large green receptacle for the safe disposal of your medications. Drugs can be dropped off with no questions asked, anytime, any day. There are a few medications we cannot accept in the green box, such as aerosols, inhalers, liquids and creams, and lotions. But other prescription or over-the-counter medication are appropriate. Located next to the drug disposal drop box in the main emergency department entrance is a disposal unit for needles and medical sharps. This container is red with a biohazard symbol and the word sharps. The service is also available to the community anytime, any day, with no questions asked. Acceptable medications should go in the green disposal box. Properly disposing of unwanted medications and sharps is your chance to do your part in stopping the opioid crisis, maintaining the integrity of our water supply, and providing a safe environment for family and friends. Safely disposing of medications and needles allows you to assist Midland Health in making Midland the healthiest community in Texas. This is Jane reading for the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, February 9th, from the Health and Wellness section. MMH, antiviral infusion available. Remdesivir requires doctor's prescription. Midland Health provided information Tuesday about another infusion therapy meant to help treat those with COVID. Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health, said those who qualify can set up an antiviral infusion treatment with remdesivir. Wilson said this is different from the antibody therapy that was formerly offered at Midland Memorial and currently offered in Odessa. He said, like a pair of antiviral medications available in pill form, the remdesivir infusion treatment requires a physician's prescription. Wilson also stated that the treatment must take place inside a 7-day window after a person is infected. He said the treatment is meant to help those patients who have had transplants or are immunosuppressed, but that physicians across Midland have more information on who can qualify for the infusion. If one gets an infection, whether vaccinated or not, your capture is within the 7-day window and you meet criteria for therapy, then please see your doctor, get an order, call the number, and come on in and get the remdesivir therapy, Wilson said. He also said the remdesivir treatment has been used with inpatients and it has been recognized as being beneficial for early infections with people who are minimally symptomatic. The antibody therapy, remdesivirs, are readily considered to be the best available options for therapy, Wilson said. He added that while the antibody therapy is a one-time infusion treatment, the remdesivir treatment takes place over 3 consecutive days. Wilson took the opportunity to remind those watching the press conference that receiving vaccinations helps prevent the infection from COVID. Midland Health officials said Tuesday that 79% of the 61 COVID inpatients at Midland Memorial Hospital were unvaccinated. Officials added there were 13 breakthrough cases, and of those 13, only 4 had received a booster. It's more important that one be vaccinated. Vaccination prevents the infection, Wilson said. That's very, very good data that whether you had just the 2 shots or the single shot of J&J, or you've had the complete series along with the booster shot, you have an increasing antibody response and a decreasing risk of infection. This is Jane reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, February 9th, from the Health and Wellness section. Abortions drop dramatically. They're down almost 60% in the first month after SB 8 restrictions imposed in Texas. Texas Health and Human Services released updated statistics Monday showing the number of abortions reported in the state decreased almost 60% in the first month after new restrictions went into effect. The state reported over 2,000 induced terminations of pregnancies for September 2021, following 5,400 in August, the last month before Senate Bill 8 took effect. Notably, in September, there were only 2 induced abortions performed after 6 weeks of gestation, which the new law allows only under medical exemptions. The data reveals that an October study by the Texas Policy Evaluation Project at the University of Texas at Austin, showing that abortions fell by 50% in September, was off by almost 10%. Texas Right to Life, an organization that opposes abortion access, said in a statement, "The success of the Texas Heartbeat Act is embodied by every child saved. For over 150 days, our work has saved an estimated 100 babies per day. Our impact is only just beginning as more states seek to replicate our success and as we look to Mississippi that could overturn Roe this summer," Director of Media and Communication Kimberly Schwartz said in the statement. Another organization that opposes abortions in the state, Texas Alliance for Life, said in a recent tweet that the decline in abortion in the state has us celebrating. Since SB 8 was enacted, women across Texas have gone to nearby states to obtain legal elective abortions. The Dallas Morning News reported that women have traveled to Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, Arkansas, and Louisiana to obtain legal abortions. The law has experienced many challenges. Most recently, the case by plaintiff Whole Woman's Health was sent from the U.S. Fifth Court Circuit of Appeals to the Texas Supreme Court to certify a question of state law regarding medical licensing officials' enforcement of the abortion law. Oral arguments at the state's highest court are set for February 24th. And despite the challenges, some other states continue to pursue legislation modeled after the new Texas restrictions. Whole Woman's Health declined to comment on the data released by the state. In a statement regarding the new data, Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas spokesperson Autumn Kaiser said, "Every day that this devastating abortion ban remains in place means more Texans are denied the ability to determine when and how to become a parent, along with increasing risk of poverty and negative health and educational outcomes. It is unconscionable that thousands of Texans continue to be forced to travel hundreds of miles out of state to Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado, and other farther states to access their fundamental right to safe, legal abortion." Last September, Planned Parenthood health centers in surrounding states saw a 1,000% increase in patients with Texas zip codes seeking abortion compared to September 2019 and 2020, the statement continued. Representative Brian Hughes, author of SB 8, said in a message to the news, "These numbers are proof that the Texas heartbeat law is working. Texas is now the first state to effectively stop most abortions. There is still more work to do, and in Texas we will continue to save the baby and support the mother," he added. Data has not been released for the rest of 2021 beyond September. The data is provisional and might be updated monthly with additional totals. The peak monthly total of abortions in the state for the year was 5,600 in March. This is Jane reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, February 9th, from the Health and Wellness section. Replacement behavior is key to changing challenging behavior. At times, you may find that your child has adopted behavior that is not conducive to a harmonious family or day-to-day routine. Sadly, many parents struggle to help their children unlearn the challenging behavior that they have acquired. When facing challenging behavior, the function or purpose of the behavior is much more important than what the behavior looks like. From the laws of behaviorism, we know that all behavior serves a purpose. It can be challenging to determine the exact purpose for a behavior and may take some time and monitoring, but shifting focus from what it looks like to what purpose it serves is the surest way to have an impact on the behavior. Four main functions of behavior. One is to get attention. Two, to avoid or escape. Three, to gain control or access. And four, self-stimulation. In order to determine the function of behavior, it is important to gather information about what is happening right before the behavior and what happens directly following the behavior. These pieces of information give you insight into the function. Once you have determined the function of the behavior, you can begin thinking of alternative ways to teach your child that will serve the same purpose but are more socially appropriate and functional. Remember, asking a child to stop a behavior without teaching them a new alternative behavior will typically result in failure. The replacement behavior is one of the most important parts of addressing challenging behavior, and new behavior must serve the same purpose as the old behavior. This is Jane reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, February 9th, from the Health and Wellness section. CDC, kids with disabilities more likely to be exposed to violence. Traumatic events can affect any child's health, raising their risk of certain diseases and negative outcomes later in life. A report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggests that one subset of kids is much more likely to go through stressful, sometimes health-endangering experiences, those with disabilities. These children were nearly twice as likely to have experienced the incarceration of a parent or guardian and more than three times as likely to have witnessed or experienced violence, the analysis shows. The study relied on data from the 2019 National Health Interview Survey and compared reports from a knowledgeable adult, usually a parent, of children with disabilities to those reported by the adults who care for children without disabilities. About 17% of children with disabilities were reported to have been a victim or a witness of violence in their neighborhood, compared with 5.3% of their counterparts. Children with disabilities were also much more likely to have lived with someone who was mentally ill or had severe depression, 21.6% versus 7.5% of children without disabilities. And 17.6% of children with disabilities have lived with someone with an alcohol or drug problem, compared with 8.6% of children without. While 64% of children with disabilities had never undergone one of those stressful events, more than 17% had undergone one, and more than 18% had undergone two or more. Children who have stressful life experiences are at higher risk for conditions such as cancer, diabetes, and mood disorders in adulthood. Risk-taking behaviors and socioeconomic challenges such as employment or low educational attainment are also higher for those who underwent stressful events as children, and multiple adverse events were associated with worse outcomes. The disparities in stressful experiences may endanger the ability for the more than 3 million children with disabilities in the United States to participate in society, the researchers said. Identifying the extent to which children with disabilities are at increased risk will inform policy to support these children and promote their health and full inclusion in society, health statistician and study author Heidi Ullman told the National Center for Health Statistics blog.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, February 8th, 2022, education section. Time passed for canceling the STAR. We hear the concern from Texas Democrats, but no, the STAR should not be canceled this year. We fall in line with popular Texas opinion that our state's standardized tests are expensive, unnecessary, high stakes, unfair, and limit learning, especially during COVID-19 pandemic. A 2022 Charles Butt Foundation poll found Texans' confidence in the STAR dropped from 49% to 44% in 2022. Democratic lawmakers often say the STAR is the top complaint they get from constituents. When State Senator Jose Menendez, who has filed bills in the past two sessions to cancel the STAR, surveyed some 13,000 Texans last spring, he found 97% of the respondents favored ending the test. a December 2021 survey of 2,500 respondents who are members of the Texas American Federation of Teachers, a statewide union of 66,000 educators, found 88% of Texas teachers don't trust the STAR. We get it. The STAR was never a brilliant idea, but it's too late to cancel. This is an example of political rhetoric running into reality. The calls for Menendez and other Democrats, including Beto O'Rourke, now running for governor, to cancel the state of Texas assessment of academic readiness exams are no surprise. In a January 26 letter to Governor Greg Abbott and the Texas Education Agency, Menendez outlined the Omicron surge, unprecedented staffing shortages, and mental health emergencies for students and staff. Taking the test as normal this year would put lives at risk and produce inaccurate data given the disproportionate challenges faced by students. While we agree with Democrats' assessment of the STAR, students should get their number two pencils ready. We're out of time and options. There is no backup plan for the state assessment scheduled for the spring, and some schools are required to give parts of a newly designed STAR and field tests that begin February 14 through 18. The federal government requires state standardized exams, and President Joe Biden and the U.S. Department of Education Secretary Miguel Cardona have emphasized normal in-person schooling. They have not spoken of waivers, and Texas has not asked. We don't expect that to change. Last spring, when COVID-19 was still keeping many students out of school buildings, we asked the STAR be canceled or postponed. It was not, but it was administered as a benchmark and, importantly, not for school accountability. This experience offers a way forward. Texas secured a waiver last year to cancel, as it did in 2020 at the onset of the pandemic, but this year it's back to normal, except that schools that received D or F ratings will be listed as no rating and will get a pass on a TEA sanction. This makes sense. Students are already attending school in person, so it isn't any more risky than normal school days. Last year's STAR showed significant declines in learning and disparities. While this wasn't surprising, the data have the potential to be helpful to address COVID learning loss. Districts need to gauge this learning loss. Yes, we know learning has been interrupted, but data must drive the way forward. Recent changes to the STAR make it more interactive and expensive. Several requirements from House Bill 3906, enacted by the 86th Texas Legislature in 2019, require the redesign of STAR that includes transitioning to online assessments next school year. Last year, the state signed four-year agreements with two companies to administer the STAR that totaled $388 million. Maybe changes in the next session will make the STAR more equitable, less high stakes, and less expensive. Some Texans are already working on it. On January 18th, Raise Your Hand Texas, a nonpartisan education public policy organization based in Austin, gathered hundreds of education experts, researchers, and policymakers for its Measure What Matters conference. The organization's leaders believe school provides much more than STAR instruction, and they plan to continue studying how best to evaluate it. We hope they find solutions. A methodical process, not an abrupt cancellation, could be the antidote to the STAR's flaws. Four students participate in science fair. The Challenge A students, which are the equivalent to 7th grade, begin preparing for the science fair in the first semester. At this point in their academic journey, they are very knowledgeable in the scientific method and have practiced the art of asking good questions. Before we break for Christmas, the students may have already determined what their hypothesis is and have implemented the beginning stages of their project. The students have to create a lab journal, which includes research problem, research question, background research, hypothesis, materials list, procedures, risk and safety, data analysis method, results, and a bibliography. Most of the students perform their tests multiple times to make sure the results are the same, and it takes anywhere from 10 to 12 weeks for their project to be complete. This year, our campus had 4 students who participated. We had a student ask if different colored cupcakes tasted different to other people. She created 3 identical recipes with only the addition of food coloring to the 2 recipes, then allowed volunteers to taste and give their opinions. Another student hypothesized that when metal comes in contact with water, it creates a chemical reaction which makes rust on certain metals. He used copper mixed with iron, graphite, and magnesium. Our third student asked what kinds of soap create the best bubbles. Her bubbles were rated on depth as well as long, how long the bubbles stayed. And our final student asked which filtration system led to the best drinking water. She added food coloring to water samples and then used a variety of filtration methods to determine which one was most effective. Every student in our campus was able to tour the science fair and listen to the presentations and practice the art of asking good questions. Then they voted on their favorite. 2 judges were chosen to grade the candidates based on their lab journal on the use of science method, on the elocution of their research paper, and how well they presented their findings verbally. The People's Choice Award went to Brielle, whose project was called I Tricked You, EYE, and she tested different colored cupcakes. First place went to Asher, whose project was titled Asher's Guide to Corrosion, and he tested the mixture of different metals and how they corroded when added to water. Those students worked extremely hard on their projects and have already inspired the younger classes to start thinking about their future projects. Bravo, Challenge A. Sewell partners with MCT to support educators. Before the start of the pandemic, Midland Community Theater began work on a program with teachers in mind. MCT is ecstatic to introduce the new Theater for Teachers program, which provides complimentary tickets to educators throughout the Permian Basin for the 2022 season. Programs like Theater for Teachers need financial support, and when the call was made, the Sewell family was happy to answer. Supporting educators across West Texas is just part of our DNA, said Andrew Marshall, marketing rep for Sewell. Coming out of the pandemic, one thing that everybody agrees on is that there has never been a more difficult time to serve as an educator. It's important we all support our educators, both in the classroom and around the community. Our hope is that school's partnership with Midland Community Theater encourages educators to take some time this year to take a breath and celebrate themselves. Each production will have a total of 50 tickets available to teachers, and these will be distributed throughout the school districts and counties of the Permian Basin to show appreciation for all their hard work and dedication by providing access to quality theater productions through our entire 2022 season here at Midland Community Theater. Ben Carson Reading Room comes to Henderson. Henderson Elementary and the Carson Scholars Fund held an assembly and ribbon-cutting ceremony for the school's brand-new Ben Carson Reading Room. The Reading Room marks the 250th since the Ben Carson Reading Project debuted in 2000. The purpose of the Ben Carson Reading Project is to create a literacy-enriched environment for children to enhance children's reading skills. It is dedicated to promoting reading as a key to unlocking a child's full potential. Dr. Ben Carson is a retired neurosurgeon and former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He co-founded the Carson Scholars Fund with his wife Candy in 1994. The nonprofit has distributed millions of dollars in scholarship funding and has built reading rooms in 23 states and Washington, D.C. Candy Carson came to Midland for the event.
Hello, friends. This is Julie reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, February 6, 2022.
This is the page 2 read. This article is entitled Grants Available to Protect Your Community from Wildfires, from OA Life, at OAOA.com. Every year, wildfires burn across Texas, and a growing number of people are living where wildfires are a real risk. It is a peril that impacts all parts of the state and can occur throughout the year. Despite billions of dollars to support wildfire suppression efforts, the number of homes lost in wildfires continues to increase. Currently, 110 counties in Texas are experiencing a burn ban. Dry vegetation, low humidity, and windy warm weather trends are all making what experts call a dangerous wildfire environment this winter. In 2021, 58,733 wildfires burned nearly 7.6 million acres in the U.S. For the ninth year, State Farm is providing grant funding to encourage communities to become wildfire ready as part of the 2022 Wildfire Community Preparedness Day. The National Fire Protection Association, NFPA, has announced that from now until February 28th, groups or individuals can apply for a $500 grant to help cover expenses for a wildfire preparedness project. The national campaign, which began in 2014, provides an opportunity for those who live in wildfire-prone areas to come together on a single day to complete projects that can help make their homes and communities safer from wildfire. Up to 100 participants from across the country are eligible to receive $500 awards to complete a planned wildfire risk reduction project on the event day, May 7th. To be considered for a project funding award, participants must submit an application by February 28th. Previous projects undertaken on Wildfire Preparedness Day have included raking and removing pine needles and dry leaves, clearing roofs and gutters of dead leaves, debris, and pine needles that could catch embers, and screening or boxing in areas below patios and decks with wire mesh to prevent debris and combustible materials from accumulating. To learn more and find additional materials to help with projects, visit the Wildfire Preparedness Day website at nfpa.org/events/national-wildfire-community-preparedness-day.
Good morning. This is Kim. I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, February 8, 2022. MCH NICU launches camera system. Children's Miracle Network at Medical Center Health System announced Monday the launch of the Angel Eye camera system at MCH's NICU. These multi-use cameras allow care teams to share patient status updates and memorable moments with real-time texts, pictures, and record videos. Angel Eye also allows for a continual video feed from the baby's isolette crib through a protected password, HIPAA-compliant website. We are so thankful to be able to bring in the Angel Eye cameras for our special families in the NICU. NICU Director Tammy Watson said in a news release, "For parents who have babies in the NICU long term, it's vital for them to be able to check in on their child at all times, even when they're not here. These cameras give them the peace of mind and comfort every parent deserves during their child's stay. When a baby is delivered preterm, or with a health condition that requires an extended hospital stay, it is difficult for mothers and fathers to remain at the hospital continuously and still maintain other work and family responsibilities, especially when parents live in remote or rural areas outside of Odessa," the release said. With these technological capabilities, parents and family members can maintain a virtual presence in the NICU when they are unable to physically be with their baby. The Angel Eye camera system is made possible by the ACE Hardware Foundation through their Helping Hand grant program. Through this donation, Children's Miracle Network at MCHS was able to purchase 15 Angel Eye cameras, We are so thankful to the Ace Hardwell Foundation for this generous donation, said Haley Swack, Program Director, Children's Miracle Network at MCHS, said in the release. With their help, MCH is able to better serve patients and their families by improving patient experience and pediatric health care. Our hope is that the Angel Eye Camera System not only promotes bonding and provides comfort, but also reduces stress and anxiety for families when they can't be there. MCH is committed to children's health throughout the region and is excited to deploy the latest technology and continue developing cutting-edge programs for women and infants in the Permian Basin.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Peritoneal dialysis at home. Dear Dr. Roach, my 96-year-old mother has stage 5 kidney disease along with congestive heart failure. She's not your typical 96-year-old. She is sharp as a tack, still attends church weekly, and is involved with the Assistance League. She is going to need to start some type of dialysis soon. We had heard that home periodontal was easier on the heart than traditional hemodialysis. When I asked our cardiologist about this, he said he'd never been asked that question before. Is home periodontal easier on the heart? Which method is better at cleaning her blood? In your opinion, which method is a better choice for my mom? Answer. The kidney's major job is to remove excess fluid, salts, and metabolic waste products from the body by filtering the blood through very complex physiology. When the kidneys fail, dialysis is a process used to take on the role of the kidney. Traditional hemodialysis uses a machine to take over the kidney's job, taking blood out of the body, filtering it, and diluting out the toxins against large amounts of fluid that approximate blood plasm. This process is very safe on the heart and is effective at removing blood toxins. Only a small amount of blood is outside the body at any given time. Peritoneal dialysis uses the peritoneum, the lining of the abdomen, which contains the organs to mimic a kidney by using large amounts of fluid inside the peritoneum to absorb waste without needing to remove the blood from the body. This is also safe on the heart and effective at removing toxins.
This is the Dear Abby column. Innocent internet search reveals a shocking secret. Dear Abby, I recently Googled my brother-in-law to see if I could find his birth date, which I had forgotten. When his name came up, so did some information I wish I hadn't seen. He's a convicted sex offender, rape, who has served time. I am assuming my sister knows about his past, but what if she doesn't? I don't want to say anything to her, because if she already knows, she'll be upset that I now know. If she doesn't know and I tell her, I'm afraid she may blame me for messing up a good thing. Should I talk to him and ask him if he's told her? Or should I leave things alone and let things play out naturally? I was shocked by the revelation because it doesn't fit the man I know. Signed, Shocked in the South. Dear Shocked, are you 100% sure the information you found is about your brother-in-law? If it's true, the revelation that there is a felon in the family, and for rape yet, would shock anyone. Talk to your sister. Explain that you forgot the date of her husband's birthday and what you discovered. It's entirely possible that she knows about his past. But if she doesn't, direct her to the site from which you got that information, because she's entitled to know. Dear Abby, my grandson is 30. He lives at home with his mother and father, both of whom are retired. He doesn't have a job, nor is he actively seeking one. The only so-called job he ever had in his life was as a security guard at a college museum, working some 20 hours per week. He is healthy, but seems to be content to continue living off his parents. They sent him to college, and he says he has a degree. His mother has told me she would never kick him out of the house. I think he should be forced to get a real job. His resume would be pathetic, but I believe if he stays on this course, he'll never be self-supporting. What do you think? Signed, Realistic Grandpa in Florida. Dear Grandpa, I think you are correct. Your grandson is not a self-starter, and thanks to his parents' generosity, he will never find the motivation to become independent. Nothing will change until his parents realize they need to encourage their son to grow up and leave the nest. Dear Abby, my middle-aged daughter and her family have been estranged from me for several years, including the last year of her father's sad battle with dementia. I am told my grandson has been taught to refer to me as the devil, although I don't know why. Recently, her husband, my son-in-law, emailed me a list of possessions from my home that they now expect to have. My late husband's wedding ring was included on the list. What would you say to the demands for items from an adult child with whom you have no relationship? Signed, Out of Their Lives in Virginia. Dear Out, please accept my sympathy for the loss of your husband. As to what I would say in response to these grasping relatives, I wouldn't dignify their demand with any response at all. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.